Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 35 of NML Crossing, where we're done with the cataclysm. We're done with the aftershock. After 35 episodes, we are finally headed where we're going to go. We're on the road to No Man's Land officially. Now, as I've been saying for the past few episodes, that's a good news, bad news situation. Because today, we start 3 days of A's reel, which, it's gonna be a trip. I'm hoping I'm able to keep these next few episodes light, and I hope we're able to have fun with them, because there ain't much to them, and it just feels very, I don't know if dorky is the right word, but it's a lot of dorkishness in these next couple of issues, the next 3 issues. But, yeah, you know, the mission statement of this show is to do the best we can with what we've got. So that's exactly what we're going to do. And before we get into it here, I take absolutely no pleasure in saying bad things about a book or a creative team. That I just want to make that clear. That brings me no joy, no glee. It's just something that when you do a project where it's all-inclusive, you're going to run into that on occasion, unfortunately. And today's issue, in fairness, it's okay. It's not the worst thing in the world. The next couple of issues are going to be, yeah. But, hey, you know, how about I stop vamping here and we just get into it? Because maybe I'm overselling it. Maybe this is a really good issue. No, it's probably not. But let's get into it. Now, this is not Asriel number 47. This is Asriel Agent of the Bat number 47. This is the first issue with the new title. Had a December 1998 cover date. The story is called A Man of Wealth and Taste. Written by Denny O'Neill with pencils by Roger Robinson. Inks, James Pasco. Colors, Demetrius Basokos. And Prismacolor. Letters, Ken Bruzniak. These names. I'm not good with normal names. You give me a Z and double S's in there, I'm lost. Edits, Frank Berrios and Mike Carlin, which, not an editorial team we've seen so far. And this one had an odd cover price. This was $3.95 because it was a flip book. We talked about this briefly. Probably way toward the beginning of this program, where this issue is a flip book with Shadow of the Bat number 80. So it's two books. You're basically, I don't know if you're saving anything, really. You might be saving like 3 cents if you because of this, because it would be $1.99 each. So you're not saving much. Or maybe you're saving a little over a quarter, because I think Asriel was a 2.25 at this point. I could be mistaken, though. Anyway, let's get in here. We open in Gotham City, where Batman and Asriel find themselves surrounded by gangbangers. Now, Batman was here to meet with Jean-Paul because he needs a favor. He needs him to go to Washington, D.C. because there's a senator named Esterbrook Halivan whose life is in danger and he's in need of some protection. Now, Asriel assumes that he's being sent because Batman finds him, quote, expendable. Batman does not correct him, probably because Asriel is awful, and he is the most expendable of his of the Bat family. Now, as this conversation plays out, the odd duo are beating the hell out of the gangbangers. Some National Guardsmen show up to corral the KO'd baddies, and in a nice touch, none of them even seem to notice Asriel's presence. They only notice Batman. And, they're kind of shocked to realize that he actually exists. Urban legend and all that. Now, this is yet another hit at for JP's ego, and Batman says he doesn't show himself often, he only dare appear when it counts. Like, right now? Like, beating up some lousy street toughs is enough for him to, like, un-urban myth himself? Oh, come on, that's silly. Back to the topic at hand, Batman talks more about Senator Halivan. You see, he's the only man in Congress who's trying to get Gotham City the money they need in order to rebuild. Asriel wonders why there aren't earthquake relief funds earmarked for catastrophes such as this. And Batman says there are. Yeah, but unfortunately, it's just a drop in a bucket compared to what they actually need. JP removes his mask and asks if he's being tested. And he also asks if Batman trusts him. Batman's all, not so much, no. He doesn't trust him. But he also assures him that this isn't some sort of twisted test. JP's being sent because, well, he's here, so he goes. He says that Oracle will fill him in on everything he needs to know about this mission. And, not a panel later, our man's already in mid-chat with Babs. And we get a bit of a political dossier on Halivan, who is somehow both a hawkish conservative and a pussycat liberal. Huh? I guess Denny's covering his bases. Now, Oracle tells our guy that the senator will be making an appearance at a rock concert tonight. A rock concert featuring, oh boy, the world-famous Nick Scratch. Nick who now? He's kind of a cringy, dorkish character. To be completely honest, it makes me almost feel bad for Denny O'Neill. Like, this character is sort of like a Marilyn Manson type. And he's written pretty much how you might expect, like, your grandfather or great-grandfather to describe him. On a side note, he kind of reminds me of the Goth from Devin Grayson's run on Titans, which was, I think that was actually, like, a clear swipe of a Marilyn Manson album cover, was that Goth character. Anyway, JP says he's never heard of Nick Scratch. And Babs says Nick Scratch is bigger than Hanson. Whew, so sign of the times there, innit? Anyway, Oracle decides that this is where we're going to get our Nicholas Scratch info dump. So, here we go. He was an astronomer at a West Coast university, and he earned his PhD at 21 years old. Now, Denny actually spells out PhD, like PEEAITCHDEE, which to me kind of sounds like, maybe it's like dismissive? Like it makes it so Babs is saying it with like an odd disrespectful lilt in her voice, which doesn't really track for me, and I might be reading into it, who knows. So Scratch was, he was this dumpy nerd, right? Or as Babs puts it, quote, a nerd, jerk, creep, stuffed shirt, squeaky boy, sissified teacher's pet loser. So yikes, tell us how you really feel there, kiddo. Anyway, again, one night Scratch was looking through his telescope when he was struck by a beam of bluish light, which apparently scrambled his insides atom by atom or something. Over the next few months, he changed completely. He would grow taller, leaner, and more handsome and charming as well. He also realized that he got himself a strong set of pipes in the exchange, and so he started a band, and he put out a bunch of hit records. He also started his own late-night talk show that blew away the competition until he got bored of it and quit. Now, JP suggests that Nick Scratch might just be the man of the year. Babs corrects him, because Scratch is actually the man of the century. So, I guess take that, literally everybody else on the planet. We next find out that Nick Scratch just started his own religion. Are we seriously doing this? Okay. It's the Church of the Blue Sword. And even though it's like days old, it's already got 500,000 devotees. So tonight, the Senator and Scratch are both performing at a rock and apparently jazz concert? Oh boy, that's certainly something, isn't it? Now, before disconnecting the call, Babs asks JP, who she keeps calling Bright Eyes. I don't remember this at all, but she asks if he found a girlfriend yet. And it's worth noting that this entire chat has been like weirdly flirty on Babs's end. She seems like real thirsty for some JPV. From here, we jump ahead to our man arriving at the... Wait a second. He arrives at the Gotham Sports Arena? I thought it was in Washington, D.C. And I mean, it doesn't look like there's any earthquake damage here, so it can't be Gotham, right? Who the hell knows? Anyway, our guy tries to get in, but is turned away as the concert is, like, all the way sold out. He then sees some creep with a bad mohawk get in by claiming to be with the band. And so JP throws on his Asriel duds and pulls the same ploy. And it works? Somehow? Okay. Inside, we see a bunch of groupies staring all moony-eyed at Nick Scratch's poster, which is really, really awkward looking. It's like, really weird. Elsewhere inside, Nick Scratch produces a weird little knife, and he tells a trio of devil-masked flunkies that they're going to have to use it to kill Senator Halivan. And the flunkies wonder why it has to be done with this particular knife. And in, like, this weird leap of logic, Scratch says it's because the knife was sold in Gotham City. Do we really have, like, hard records on where knives are bought and sold? I mean, clearly I don't own an arsenal of my own, so I don't know. I mean, Gotham, despite its current state of disrepair, is still a major metropolitan area, yes? How would it possibly matter that a friggin' knife was bought there? Anyway, Scratch tells the Devilheads that the murder will occur on the catwalk above the stage. Just then, the Senator enters the scene, and he introduces himself as Esty. Not to be confused with Kefauver, probably. Now, Esty, it turns out, is a huge fan of Nick Scratch. He says he just told the President to buy the Nick Scratch CD box set for his grandkids. And I didn't know that Bill Clinton was a grandfather back in ye olde 1998. Then again, maybe he was and just didn't know. Now, the Senator promises to clap till his hands go raw during the concert, so, alright, let's dial it back a notch there, old fella. Scratch tells him he'll have a special view of the show from the catwalk above the stage. You see, he needs to go up there because there's someone who really wants to meet him and discuss an arms deal. Esty wonders how a rock and roller is so in the know about this. A rock and roller. Oh, Lord. Scratch says he's got a face people trust or something like that. And so it's time to start the show. And you all ready for Cringe Fest 98? Eh, me neither. We get us an MC who riles up the crowd. He refers to them as alien creatures. And he threatens that Mulder and Scully are there looking for them. Oh. Nick Scratch takes the stage, and he thanks everyone for coming. Everyone except Jabba the Hutt. Like, what the hell are we You might think that that's like a little cute one-off reference. But no. The Jabba thing ain't over. Now, Scratch points to Jabba in the crowd and asks if he's looking for Leia. But he's got bad news, since she's already hooked up with the Emperor. What the hell is this? Okay, let's head up to the catwalk. We'll rejoin old Esty, where he finds himself surrounded by the Devilheads. One of them draws the legendary Gotham knife, to which the Senator draws his pistol, which gets kicked out of his mitts, like, immediately. Now, you would think a gun falling from the catwalk during a rock concert might elicit some sort of reaction, but you'd be wrong. By now, Asriel has swooped in to save the day, and over the course of the next 4 pages, he does just that. Esty even gets a punch in on one of the Devilheads for good measure. Now, this evidently took, like, I don't know, an hour? Maybe 2? Because as the dust settles, Nick Scratch is already done with his rock show. He tells the audience that he's off for some beauty rest, and he threatens to see them all again soon, if they can bear it? I'll be back if you can bear. I gotta be honest here, I feel, like, really bad reading this and trying to analyze it. This is giving me, like, these odd pangs of Chris Claremont trying to write young people dialogue, where it's like, it ain't there. Anyway, backstage, Scratch runs into Esty, who is understandably shaken and quite annoyed that, you know, he was almost just killed by the Devilheads. Scratch invites him back into his dressing room so they can chat. Once there, Scratch proceeds to strangle the Senator to death. And that's where we leave it. Next time out, more Asriel. Now, before we get into our thoughts on the issue, we do have a From the Den essay. It's our first one since, it's been a while. It was the first episode. So, it's been a minute, right? Now, this From the Den is dated July 1998. So, probably 2 or 3 months before this issue hit the stands here. Now, the missive opens up with a refresher in regards to the 20-month Bat Office moratorium on crossovers and stories not going for longer than 3 chapters and how that all came to an end with Cataclysm. But that was originally supposed to be it. Just 1 17-part cross-event and then back to separate corners for the entire Bat line. But on a certain Monday morning, Denny was approached by Jordan B. Gorfinkel, who had an idea he wanted to pitch. It was a 12-page outline for something he called No Man's Land. Now, the pitch was a bit sheepish. Gorfinkel assumed that Denny would hate it and immediately shoot it down, but old Gorf was wrong, because Denny saw No Man's Land as an amazing challenge and opportunity that, if done successfully, would be incredible. And so, Denny started to solicit ideas from the rest of DC's editors, Peterson, Vincenzo, Levitz, Carlin, Chiarello, Raspler, among others, to try and flesh out the concept. Now, Gorfinkel would take it upon himself to start fishing the creative talent pool, looking for some new blood, and he found several new voices for the Bat books. Now, Denny himself would steal Larry Hama away from Marvel Comics. Now, it wasn't just new writers they were looking for, they also started drafting new draftsmen. Alex Ross, Mike Diodato, John Byrne, Alex Maleev, Frank Terran, Wayne Foucher. And one name sticks out to me. John Byrne? Really? I don't remember that at all. Denny then lays out to us what No Man's Land is gonna be. It's not exactly a crossover, but it's also not exactly not a crossover. Now, the premise is as follows. The United States government decides to abandon Gotham City after a devastating earthquake. It's not done overnight, nor is it done without a struggle. But eventually, the powers that be decree that Gotham is beyond redemption, not worth the trillions of dollars needed to rehabilitate it. Good citizens flee by the millions, which means that the city becomes the domain of bad citizens, the very bad citizens, who find a haven amid the shattered remains of once splendid buildings. Then a few heroes and heroes-to-be say no. They refuse to accept defeat and undertake to reclaim what is rightfully theirs inch by inch, block by block, fighting with whatever weapons they can find, willing to sacrifice everything, including their own lives. That saga, according to Denny, starts here, in the Azrael Shadow of the Bat flipbook. And it'll continue throughout all of the Bat books, even including Legends of the Dark Knight, which wasn't known for playing ball with current-day stories. Then he addresses some potential concerns in regards to, well, how many of these damn books people are going to have to buy in order to keep up. Now, he promises that you will be able to pick and choose what you buy and read. Though, there will also be stories that do cross into books you might not actually usually purchase. And he hopes that the stories told in them are good enough to justify the added expense and potential inconvenience. He also promises a hell of a ride over the course of the next year, which I guess really tells us the scope of the story. He hopes that once the dust settles and No Man's Land is over, that we'll all have a better appreciation for what a civilization is. He also promises another From the Den missive next month. Spoiler alert, no, there won't be. In my script here, it's like, so we'll check that out next time. But there is none. But that's Denny's missive and his, invitation to join him in No Man's Land. It's pretty cool to hear from Denny again. It's pretty cool to read something in this book by Denny that doesn't make me cringe. I feel so bad saying that because, Denny's a legend, right? It's just, this ain't it, unfortunately. But how about we get into some thoughts about the story here? Maybe I oversold it, because it wasn't the worst thing. But like I said at the start of the show, I can tell you that this is the highlight of the 3 issues we're going to be looking at. And again, I almost feel bad trying to critique it. It feels to me, and I mentioned this earlier, it feels like any time I try and discuss post-2000 Claremont on the Xbox, like there's glimmers of the good stuff there, and that voice that you just love and you're comfortable with. But at the same time, it all kind of feels like it's well past its sell-by date. It feels like a relic, you know, but at the same time, not like Denny's old work. You know, it doesn't feel like a throwback, it just feels out of touch. It feels old, musty, mothball-y. And I mean, I don't think comics are ever considered to be, like, on the cutting edge or hip. But if we could say that comics can be hip, this is like the anti that. So, do we talk about Nicholas Scratch? Why this guy? It's just such a dorky character. And not to spoil anything, but Denny's gonna try and make Scratch like Asriel's arch nemesis. He's going to make it all the way to the final issue of this volume. Number 1 friggin' 100. Now we learn here that he's like the idol to beat all idols, right? And I kind of wish that Denny'd dropped like little bits and pieces about Scratch in some earlier issues, because this whole thing is very much out of nowhere. And it reads like it too. And of course, that's not out of the ordinary for comics. But I mean, the Bat Office was clearly planning No Man's Land for a little while now. You'd almost think they'd try and promote the fact that one of the most famous people on DC Earth whatever was going to be making his presence felt. And again, he's just such a dorky character. Halivan, let's talk about Halivan here, kind of a plot device of a character. His death will figure into the rest of this arc. Actually, it's pretty much going to inform the rest of this arc and beyond. I'll hand it to Denny for somehow making him both a liberal and conservative. I guess he didn't want to make too many waves. Then again, I don't know that we necessarily needed to know his political viewpoints. Outside the whole being a friend of Gotham thing, that's all we really needed to know. His fanboying over Scratch was a bit, like a big reminder that Denny wasn't a young man anymore. And I mean, I pointed this out there in the synopsis, but he literally referred to Nick Scratch as a, quote, rock and roller. Tell me, have you ever called anyone a rock and roller? There was that issue of Sovereign 7. That was the Claremont book from the mid-late 90s at DC. There was an issue where the team met up with Superman and Lois Lane. It was Electric Blue era Superman. And like Lois was telling whatever the hell the leader of Sovereign 7, I don't remember her name, but like they went into a bar and Lois is like, strike a pose, girl. And it's like, Then you picture Chris Claremont writing that, and it's just like, no. And I mean, not only do we get the rock and roller, but we get like the weird X-Files and Jabba the Hutt crap. I mean, oof. I think that's probably all I have to say. I don't know that there's much to relitigate. I guess overall, I don't know that this is one you absolutely need in your collection. I suppose that would have to depend a great deal on your Asriel mileage. My Asriel mileage is quite low. If that's even, you know, like, mileage may vary. How do you answer that kind of question? Do you say I have high mileage or low mileage? I'm just not really into Asriel is what I'm trying to say here. If you dig them, yeah, you might dig this. If you don't, well, you probably won't. But it is a necessary chapter in our road to No Man's Land, so here we be. But that's all I got to say about it here. Let's do a quick dip into the NML bag here, and check in with our good friend Walt, who sent in some of his thoughts here. He says, in regards to bags and boards, so I do flap over top to back with tape. One local shop does the upside down, and I tried that, but it just doesn't work for me and my OCD. Depending on how risky I feel, I'll fold the tape in on the flap before removing an issue to make sure it doesn't touch the issue itself. But just as often, it tears when I open the thing, so the point becomes moot. And that's something I've found, too. I mean, especially with these books here that have been in back issue bins for a quarter of a century. You know, the tape is ancient, right? So when you buy them at the shop here and you try to take the tape off of them, it just rips. It just comes right apart. The upside down thing, that is so weird to me. It'll never not be weird to me. And it's the thing of it is one of my very, very favorite shops to go to does the upside down flap. And I just don't get it. Like I maybe that was just normal. I don't know. But to me, even when I was, you know, new to the hobby and new to the fandom here, it always just seemed like it should go, you know, the flap on top. And of course, I don't mess with tape. That's something that I've said. And I mean, I really don't have as I've said before, I don't have like an excuse for why I do it. It's like, I feel like I always just need to be able to access the books. And like Walt said here, he'll fold the tape in to make sure it doesn't touch the book. I would just be so nervous. I'd be so ginger with it that I'd probably wind up doing more damage trying not to let it touch the tape than had it touched the tape. But, you know, you guys know my gimmick here. I fold the flap in between the book and the backing board. Those are just the books that are bagged and boarded. I'd probably say that maybe a third to half of my collection is not bagged nor boarded. It's just straight up unprotected. And, you know, I actually did a little bit of a bagging and boarding project about a week and a half ago because I've been looking at prices at some of these books here, and I saw, you know, the issue of Batman, it's the Todd McFarlane cover. I think he did an homage to it on a cover of Spawn recently. If you saw it, you'd know it. It's like an orange cover. It's a really cool looking cover. And I found that in a quarter bin, like 10, 15 years ago. And so I got it out of the bin, chucked it in a box, and it was not protected in any way. And then I saw in my like eBay recommendations, because I did buy that Harley Quinn thing not too long ago. But in my recommendations was that issue, and it was like $250. It's like, you're kidding me? So I did wind up bagging and boarding it. And, you know, of course, the flap is between the book and the backboard. But it's weird. It's weird. Comic back issue prices have gone pretty nuts since probably since COVID. I think that's when the worm started to turn, at least in my experience. Where, and this is something that me and Walt talk about a lot, those books that you find in the, you know, dime and quarter and 50 cent bins are suddenly, like, they're not even just back issue bin books, they're wall books now. It's so bizarre, so bizarre. And I think a lot of that started with COVID and, yeah, people just, I don't know, people rediscovering things from their youth and really, really affecting the value of things. Now back to Walt. He says, regarding Jack Drake, of course that's Tim Drake's father, that part of Identity Crisis was probably the hardest for me of the story. I can't relate to having a spouse to lose, Ralph and Sue, but I did have a dad, and even the idea of losing him at all was hard enough to even begin to allow myself to try and get my head around that. I really liked that Tim had his parents, and then at least his father. So many other thoughts on the topic. Tim being adopted by Bruce was the best of a bad situation, and it worked for me given the loss of Jack. Still hated his being the sacrificial lamb from the bat office for Identity Crisis. Same as on the Superman side, I don't care if the Golden or Silver Age used the death of Clark's parents. I found them to be such a compelling driving part of the character, his dynamics, motivation, inspiration, etc., that I hated John being killed off at the start of the new Krypton stuff. And that's a really excellent point there. Now, I never had a close relationship with my father. So It's kind of hard for me to wrap my head around that. Identity Crisis for me was all about, the aforementioned Ralph and Sue. That's where I got hung up, and that's where I got choked up, you know. But your point is well taken here with, and I think Chris, you and Eric and CJ mentioned this as well earlier, that Tim was special because he didn't have, the original trauma of Batman, right? He had a parent. He had a, biological parent who raised him, and that made him different. That made him different from Jason. It made him different from Dick. And it made him different from Bruce. And how the way things were going around this point, where all signs were pointing to Tim as the replacement for Batman, I think that was an opportunity to have a Batman with a totally different dynamic. And it's unfortunate that that went away for a stunt. I mean, Identity Crisis, I think I've mentioned this before, like, that there was something in the air, there was something in the ether in the comics industry around that time where toys were just getting broken for the hell of it. You know, I don't know if it was an attempt to prove that comics were literature. I mean, we brought Brad Meltzer in, a novelist, a prize-winning novelist, to do this story. I don't know if this was an attempt to legitimize something that doesn't need to be legitimized, because comic fans love comics. We don't need it to be anything other than what it is. But, the loss of Jack there felt like a stunt. It felt like they needed to kill someone, because they needed to show the stakes of the story. And it's unfortunate. On to John Kent. I hated that they took him out before New Krypton. I'm a post-crisis guy. I loved the fact that Clark had parents. I mean, you guys know that I don't dig TV shows or movies based on comics, but I made an exception. Back when we moved to Arizona, we went from having like 75 channels to like 15 when we came out here. The cable was not great. So, you kind of had to watch what was on. And one of the channels we had was TNT, and I think they had like a 2-hour block every day of Lois and Clark. It wasn't a show I watched when it was, on live or on new, first run, but I watched it because it was on, and I loved the fact that Clark had his parents. I thought they added so much. I thought that they grounded, Clark and Superman. They just made it feel different. There was no trauma of having lost the people who raised him. And I thought that that was really cool, especially with my limited knowledge of Superman at the time, coming from the death of, and how powerful the scenes from the funeral were when John and Martha arrive in Metropolis. And it's a really, really painful scene to read. I remember it hit me very, very oddly. Like, I wasn't expecting it. There were a couple of scenes from the funeral run that kind of kicked me in the face. And one of them was John and Martha arriving, and they, they meet up with Lois. And, they get lost in the fact that they lost someone very special to them, but the world also lost Superman. And it's like they couldn't mourn the way they needed to. And they couldn't mourn publicly, of course, because that would, that would reveal everything. And that was a tough one. And you couldn't do that kind of scene without the parents. And I felt like that added so much. And it made the death feel even more tragic than it already was. And another one of the scenes from the funeral for a friend that, kind of threw me for a loop was Bibbo putting on a Superman shirt. That was a toughie. But it was such an amazing scene. It was an amazing dynamic that to kill the character was, it was the Dio days, right? I mean, the Dio was big on killing things and being very proud of killing things. As I guess, I mean, do we even say that's a trick pony? I mean, if that's all you do is flush things down the toilet, I don't know. But I definitely want to thank Walt for writing in here. I know that that's not an easy thing to discuss, so I really appreciate your writing in with those thoughts. And of course, if anybody out there would like to join in on the conversation, I encourage and invite you to do so. You can find me all those ways, I always say. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, Facebook, Twitter X, all those places. But I think that's going to do it for today. I'm hoping that the next couple of episodes aren't like 5-minute episodes, because it might be a little difficult finding things to say, but as always, we'll do our best. But I'd like to thank you all so much for taking some time out of your day today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks.